Okay. Thank you guys for being here. My name is Carissa Walters Wilson. I grew up in the Church of Christ. My dad taught at Harding for a long time, taught New Testament. We lived in Searcy for a while. I went to Harding for a few years. I got an undergraduate degree in classical studies, so that means I learned lots of dead languages, ancient Greek, Koine Greek, Latin, and then I went to grad school for New Testament studies at Yale Divinity School, and I got a concentration in New Testament studies there where I picked up my biblical Hebrew, and I got all of this stuff that I really, really enjoyed and I love to do, and now I'm going to share it with you. So hopefully we can have a good time together today and work through some texts and learn something together. So the end of last summer, when I knew I was going to be coming back here, and I knew what the topic was, I had a whole plan for what I was going to discuss. I was going to do a whole piece on the ancient context of meals and how meals in the ancient world were a place of exercising inequalities, and all of this kind of stuff is the context for the Lord's Supper. And it was going to be great, and that is a great topic, so hopefully someone will be talking about it. But then I got an email in September from a woman who has known me my whole life and been like a second mom. And it kind of derailed me into what I was going to do. And in this email, she expressed frustration over where the dialogue or lack of dialogue was in terms of the role of women in churches of Christ. And it was the end of the email that really kind of hit me between the eyes. And she said, the words that really hit me were, "We are too timid to step forth in faith, to apply them today in areas that are uncomfortable for us." And if you know me, if you grew up with me, as some of you, a couple of you in this room have, I have never been a particularly timid person. I am loud, I am opinionated, I am argumentative, especially about things that I care about. And this issue about women and churches of Christ is something that I care a lot about because of who I am and because of my passion for the Bible and for teaching the Bible. I have a lot invested in this issue. But in spite of all that, as I reflected, as I read these words on my computer screen, I realized that I had, in fact, over the last decade, become timid. Over the last decade, I had gotten afraid. Because I was in communities with people that I loved, and because in these communities, oftentimes, when these issues, and not just this issue, but issues that are emotional, personal, that have to do with identity, that have to do with really core beliefs, really important issues like this, when they come up, they seem to just destroy things. They make such a mess. And you don't want to make a mess in the middle of people that you love. And I had become afraid. But this email, it really challenged me to think again about the location of that fear and whether fear as spiritual people of God is an appropriate emotion. Because I think we are called to be anything but fearful. We are called to step out in faith. So as I started to reflect on these arguments that we're having and why we're having them and what in the world is going on, it seemed like we weren't actually even having arguments, right? A lot of times what's happening is we're just looking across at each other, telling each other why the other person is wrong, right? We're not actually discussing anything of real substance. We're picking up the text. We're not even talking about the text. We're not dialoguing about it. We're picking them up and throwing them at each other. And that is extremely destructive. And it is an embarrassing use of the Word of God. And what's even more disturbing to me about that is the fact that we are people of God. We are the creation of God. We are the new creation of God. Right? And I don't think that just means that me, as an individual, I'm a new creation. Right? God is doing a work in me, and that is wonderful and beautiful. But God is also doing a work in all of us, right? As a community. the community, the body of Christ, the church, is also the new creation of God, and it is Spirit-filled. So how is it that this creation of God, Spirit-filled, beloved by Him, cannot talk to each other about things that matter? And what upset me about this is that I think it's not just this fear that we are going to hurt each other with our words has now become a fear of saying anything at all. That if we just pretend like we all agree with each other, right? If we hold that sense of unity up, unity that means we don't disagree, which is a debatable sense of the word unity. Unity that means that we disagree is a beautiful and everything looks smooth and nice and we can all be together and have potluck together and go to each other's homes for life groups and everything's great. But under the surface, that stuff has not gone away. It hasn't gone away. We still have cracks. We have fissures. So I refocused my efforts on my topic to try to think about how can we come up with some kind of a solution for how we talk to each other. How can we make this better? And I want to try to use an illustration here. Okay. So over Easter break, or Easter weekend, my family, my husband and our two kids, were driving up to Vermont, and at the same time, my sister, her husband, and their two kids were driving up from New York City. We were driving up to Vermont, where my parents were, to celebrate the holiday with them. And, you know, it's a decently long drive, 7 hours from us north of Philadelphia, 5-some-odd hours for them north of New York City. And eventually, though, all roads to Vermont lead to 91. And about 5:30, I get a phone call from my sister, and she says, "Hey, we're going to stop and get something to eat. Where are you guys? What's your mile marker?" I said, "Oh, we're about mile marker 34. She said, "Great, we're 4 miles behind you." I said, "All right, I'm going to get off at the next exit. You get off at the next exit, we'll meet up, we'll figure out where we're going to eat, and we'll have dinner together and then caravan the rest of the way up." So my husband and I, he pulls off at the next exit, we stop on the side of the road to wait for them, and we wait, and they don't show up. And about 5 minutes later, I give my sister Liz a call, and I say, "Where are you?" And she says, "Where are you?" And I said, "Well, I got off at the exit." She said, "So did I." So is there an exit in between us? She's like, "Well, I don't know. I'm at exit 24. I said, "That's impossible. We're at exit 5. You don't go from 24 to 5. And then you can imagine what a discussion between two sisters that are 2 years apart sounded like over the phone, which was, "You must be on the wrong road." "No, you're on the wrong road. Are you sure? I think you probably missed an exit. I think you're on the wrong road." And it went back and forth like this for an embarrassingly long period of time before we realized that although we were on the same road, at the same mile marker, we were in different states. She was in Massachusetts with her family, and I was in Vermont with mine. And I think that this is a reasonably good metaphor for how our conversations are breaking down. Because we may think we're talking about the same issues. We may be using the same language. We may be reading the same text, but we are standing in very different places. These places are so different, in fact, that sometimes we cannot even see where the other person is. And although it feels like we're talking to each other from the same place, we're not. We're talking past each other, we're talking at each other, and nothing is accomplished. So how do we fix this? So over today and tomorrow, what I want to do is walk through a suggestion, a series of steps that we'll go through together. And you may hate them. You may be inspired to come up with your own. Regardless, what we're going to do is I'm going to take two different readings of some passages that pertain to gender identity and equality. I'm going to read these same passages from two different perspectives, and we're going to walk through these steps to see how these two perspectives might find a way to talk to each other. Now, there are a ton of passages that I could choose to use that have bearing on issues of gender and identity and equality, So given our time constraints, I'm going to focus on where I think the center of the debate is, which is the original creation, Genesis 1 to 3, and the new creation as presented in Paul, particularly we will end up in Galatians 3. So we're going to look at these two sets of scriptures from two different perspectives. We're going to read through them from two different perspectives, and then we're going to see how these two might interact together. Okay? All right, so step one. And taking with the mat metaphor, we're going to use our roots. So roots for reconciliation, or routes, depending on which part of the country you're from. Number one, this seems kind of small and silly and insignificant, but I would argue it is one of the most important steps to talking. You have to actually want to come together on an issue, right? This picture that I showed before, if all you want to do is drag someone else to where you're standing, if you have no interest in what they might have to teach you about the issue, then your conversation is over before it starts. That cannot be your principal goal. The principal goal has got to be to come together in some way. How can we get closer to each other? At the very least, how can I learn to see where you're standing? Okay, number two. Figure out where you are. Again, that might seem like a simple thing, but once you look around yourself, you want to see, where am I standing, right? How did I get here? What do I believe? What are my assumptions? What is my context? Because these kinds of things have enormous bearing on how we talk to each other, on where I'm standing. They have enormous bearing then on how I read Scripture. So that brings us to the idea that we must, under this, on number two, we must acknowledge that there is such a thing as interpretation. I know interpretation was a bad boogeyman in the past. Interpretation was the thing that got in the way of real reading of Scripture. But interpretation happens. It's the bringing to a text just a set of assumptions or beliefs, questions, strategies. That's all it is, right? And it's something that we all do. And the problem is if you're not aware of what's informing your interpretation, if you haven't sat down and really analyzed that and unpacked it, then you're likely to fall victim to the idea that everything you see in the text is common sense, right? It's clear, it's plain, it's common sense. Doesn't get very far in an argument when you use that kind of terminology. And anyone who's really spent some time with someone who has a different set of beliefs or practices because they come from another culture has probably realized that common sense can look very different depending on the context that you come from. So once we understand that we are interpreting from a particular place, right, and we learn to be critical of that place, right, that makes space to recognize that other people are doing the same thing, right? That makes space to recognize that there's more than one way to read a text. Now, we may not say that out loud that often, but we already do it. You've probably experienced it yourself when you've gone to a text that you've been to many times in the past. But for some reason this time, you came to it with a different question and you saw something there that you had never seen before, right? It spoke to you in a different way. Did that mean that what you saw in your previous reading was not true? You had a different question, right? So if you go to a text and you're asking questions of history, you're going to find something different than if you go to a text and you're asking questions about comfort, right? But both are held in the text in that way, right? So we recognize where we sit, where we're standing, the role of interpretation in that process, and the fact that there are multiple meanings of a text allows space for us to actually have dialogue and space for us to investigate where the other person is standing. Discover where the other person is standing. Now, this does not mean judge where the other person is standing. Number three is all about listening. right? The motivation there is not to analyze what they're saying in terms of how it agrees with you or how it doesn't. There's no place for judgment in this step. It's just about entering into their space to listen and to understand how they got where they are, to understand what their environment looks like, what their context is. Then you can step back and describe these two different locations. What are their commonalities that can be built on? What are the real differences in their location? Right? Because sometimes the differences we think are there are much less important than the real difference between these locations that lies underneath, which we'll talk about later. And then we can come to the point of designing a route for reconciliation. Can we build on that commonality to get a little closer to each other? How might we envision a place where we both could stand together? Or at the very least, how can we at least learn how to interact with each other in a more constructive way because we know where the other person is and we know where we are? All right, so these are the steps we're going to go through with two different positions and see how it works out. So the two positions that I'm drawing from, one would fall under a very large and diverse umbrella that is often called complementarianism. And the other would be a very large and diverse umbrella that could be termed egalitarianism. Now, there are lots and lots of readings that could fall under those two categories, and I can only give one from under each one. So, let's just define some terms here for a second. Complementarianism. So, essentially what's being argued here is that although men and women are of equal value and status to God, they were created for different roles. And in those different roles is a hierarchy. That the hierarchy of those two roles, men have certain roles that are placed above the roles of women. Now, those two roles are not any less valuable to God. They're just different, and they complement each other. Right? And this has been prescribed from the very beginning. Egalitarianism says although there are, you know, some obvious biological distinctions between men and women, that the equality between men and women is not just one of their status before God. It's also an equality of function, an equality of role. Okay? All right. So before we get to Genesis, two things. Scholars will divide Genesis into two accounts, and you probably noticed this in your own reading, right? The first part has a very different style and a different focus in chapter 1 than in chapter 2. So there's lots of different names, a cosmological account, a cosmic account. The first account really describes these generations of creation, right? This is the one in Sunday school where you learn day 1 this happened, day 2 this happened, day 3 this happened. And the focus is really on the movement from chaos, right, that formless void, into an ordered cosmos, into an ordered creation that culminates with the creation of the human person, right? The second account, we could call it the garden account, the paradise account, in chapters 2 through 3, focuses on the creation of the human person. The human being is the central figure in this. And there's a move there from sort of void to ordered creation, then to chaos again when you come to chapter 3 and the fall. They sit right next to each other in our Bibles, and they inform each other when we read them together. But they are properly, in scholarship, referred to as two different accounts. Okay, second thing to be aware of is the problem of the Hebrew word Adam. There is a translational issue here that doesn't really come through in the English very well. Because Adam, just like English words, can mean multiple things depending on its context. So I can run to my car, I can score a run in baseball, or I can have a run in my pantyhose, right? These things all mean different things depending on their context, even though they're the same word. So Adam is a play on the word Adama, which means ground, built from the ground. And it can mean humanity, humankind, human being, a general word for human beings, right? It can also mean a man, right? And it can also mean a particular man whose name is Adam. inherent in this word is all three of those meanings. So when your translator assigns one of those meanings, they have made an interpretive move based on the context. Okay? And sometimes translators make different choices there, which will be reflected in your translation. But regardless, it seems almost like the writer is playing off of this ambiguity on purpose. It's very interesting to think about it that way. It's certainly a possibility. But it doesn't come through in the English and sometimes can complicate the issue. Something to be aware of, and you're going to notice it in just a minute. All right. A complementarian reading of Genesis 1 to 3. All right. So the part of Genesis 1, this cosmic account that we want to focus on, is right here in 27 to 28. So you see the word Adam there, right? In the NIV, and I've used the NIV for the complementarian position because that is one that I frequently, that is a translation I frequently see in a complementarian interpretation. So I've used it here. Mankind, Adam, right? So you can see they've used the generalized translation of that word. In our image, so they can rule. So God created mankind, again, in his own image. In the image of God, he created, you see this, them? The Hebrew word is him. It's actually singular, not plural. Now, it's common in Hebrew to use a singular third person pronoun to also be used in the plural. You can do it that way. But if you go look at the American Standard Version, King James Version, Revised Standard Version, English Standard Version, they're going to keep it him. And it's, again, this confusion. What do you do with this word Adam? If we're talking about humankind, we're talking about humankind in the plural, so this is a singular being used as a plural, like is used in other places in Hebrew. Or can we think about mankind in the singular? Are we talking about a singular? Do you see the kinds of issues that get debated across a translator's table? Okay. Male and female, he created them, blessed them, fruitful and multiply. Right? Okay. Genesis 2. The Lord God formed. Now, same word, right? Ha is the. It's an article. So, formed a man, the man. So we changed from saying mankind to a man. Formed from the dust of the ground, see the Adama, and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and the man became a living being again. Ha Adam as man. Okay, so the singular in this translation, and in from a complementarian position, the singular man, God sees this man and says, this guy is lonely, and he needs someone to be with him, right? So God says, you know what would be great would be an azer kenegdo, a helper. In the NIV, it says a helper suitable for him. Now, from a complementarian position, most of the time, we're going to focus on this word azer. And talk about the sense of helper. And you might have seen this phrase come down to us as helpmeet. It's a very unfortunate translation from the King James Version. When the King James Version was actually done, meet meant something closer to suitable, right? So it made sense then. It doesn't really make sense now. But it's sort of been popularized by books like Created to Be His Helpmeet by Debbie Pearl and some of those other kinds of works that talk about biblical womanhood and manhood. And they talk about helper in the sense of helper as an assistant, right? So when we think of helper, a lot of times we think about a secretary or the help, the person who does for you what you need to support you and is therefore in a kind of subordinate position to you. So the assistant is subordinate to the administrative assistant is subordinate to the president of the company, right? The president of the company is the one in charge. That's the sense of helper that gets focused on there. And kenegdo, suitable is a good translation. It's kind of a funky word, in front of, but it somehow, in some way corresponds to him, right? So he looks at all the animals and deals with the animals. We don't find an azer kenegdo. And so God causes the man to fall asleep. He takes his rib and he creates woman, Isha, from the rib he took out of the man. And then the man can see this woman in front of him who he can now see such commonality with. But from a complementary perspective, it's important to recognize that she came from him, right? He was created first, and like a firstborn, that gives him a primary position in the relationship. In addition, he was created in a rather dramatic and majestic way, right? I mean, the picture of God forming him from the ground and breathing life into him, the imagery is beautiful, right? Whereas this poor Isha was just a rib pulled out of his side. It's very insignificant, part, and he kind of cobbles something together, right? And, I mean, there's so many really unfortunate puns from the Middle Ages about this rib. But regardless, we now have this relationship where this woman was created from the man in order to be his helper, right? Okay. Then we have the encounter between Eve and Adam, who's over there not paying attention, and the serpent. And Eve takes the apple, eats it in order to be like God, and then she passes it on to Adam, who eats it himself. They realize they're naked, they get upset, they hide from God, God finds them, and God pronounces punishment. So to the woman, he says, I will make your pains in childbearing very severe, painful labor, and your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you. Now, this is a very hierarchical kind of statement, right? But we already have hierarchy in the account from a complementarian perspective, because man was created first, like the firstborn, in the primary position. She was created to help him. So that original hierarchy from a complementarian position, from this reading that I'm giving, is a good hierarchy. It's a hierarchy where the man, although he's in a position over her, is there to care for her and to nurture her and to, in all ways, love her as he loves himself, even though he is in a position of higher authority than her. But here, when sin enters the world, that hierarchy is subverted, it's perverted into a kind of domineering ruling. So men, after the fall, have a tendency, or women have been punished, to be under the rule of domineering men who treat them cruelly as a punishment, rather than the good kind of hierarchy that God originally put in place. Does this make sense? Okay. All right. Then Adam also got punished. So this ground that he came from will now be in conflict with him, and he will have to toil all the days of his life. All right, so let's move to an egalitarian reading. Same text, okay? All right, so this is the NRSV, New Revised Standard Version. I use it for the same reason that I use the NIV in the other one. It tends to be a common translation used for egalitarian interpretations. God said, let us make, see, they switched mankind to humankind, but it is still a similar idea, right? So the Adam there is being used as a general statement, as a general concept for human beings, rather than just a man or the man Adam. And let them have dominion. And then let's come down here. So Phyllis Trible and some other egalitarian scholars pointed to the poetic structure of this phrase, of verse 27. So it's a little convoluted here. So if you look back at it before in the English ordering of words, so God created humankind in his image. In the image of God, he created them or him. Male and female, he created them. So if we put them in the order of their Hebrew words, so created God humankind in his own image. Right? In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. See how we've got, and I separated what are individual words. So these words here are parallel to each other in the poetic structure of the text, right? These words are basically the same, right? We have he created, and then we have a pronoun. Do you see what I'm saying? So if you look at them from a poetic structural standpoint, this corresponds to this, right? So the image of God corresponds to male and female. Male and female reflect or are the image of God. Do you see that make sense? Male and female both, right? Male is not given primacy as being the image of God, as opposed to females not being, or a more distant image of God. Or you could even argue that male and female have to be together. Together they represent the image of God. The other thing that gets focused on from an egalitarian perspective in this verse is the word them. Let us make humankind in our image according to our likeness, and let them, both of them, There's actually no distinction here in chapter 1 over what the two of them are allowed to do. So they both are given the same command for their role in the world. They are both told to have dominion over the fish of the sea, over birds of the air, over cattle, and upon every creeping on the earth. Okay? So as far as chapter 1, we have no distinction between roles, and they both reflect the image of God from an egalitarian perspective. Okay, so now we're to chapter 2. Formed man. Now you see here, it doesn't say a man, it says man. So what's happening here? If we only have this one being created, and if the woman is later going to be taken out of it, do we have a male before we have a female? Does this creature that God has made from the dust of the earth and reflects the image of God hold within it some sort of essence of both male and female? But in either sense, we're still with this Ha'adam. It's a sort of an ambiguous term. Okay. Now we're back to this verse with our Azer Kenegdo. Now remember I said that the complementarian position looks at helper from the perspective of a subordinate, right? Or someone who assists. So from egalitarian scholars said, well, let's look at the word Azer and how it's used in other places in the Bible. And if you look at that word, and you look throughout the Old Testament, you will find that almost every time this word is used, it is used of God. That God is a helper. So when God helps the armies of Israel, when God is, when David calls out for God to help him, right, you're using Azer. So in that context, it's very hard to imagine that when David asks God to help him, he's implying that God is somehow subordinate to him, right? So an egalitarian scholar would argue that you can't say that, that inherent in the word Azer is subordination. It might be there in depending on context, but it's not necessarily there. Because there are plenty of times when it refers to God, and God's not subordinate to anyone. And they'll focus then on the word kenegdo. Now you remember, this is kind of a funky word to translate. It literally means kind of in front of, right? So the sense of standing in front of, looking you in the eye. And egalitarian scholars said that stresses the equality of these two creatures, right? The fact that she can look him in the eye and stand before him face to face is really, see how we get in this translation, helper as a partner, right? That's very different than some other translations. It's really stressing that this helper is not a subordinate, but rather an equal partner. Okay, so the Lord causes a deep sleep to fall upon the man because they didn't find the Azer Kenegdo among the animals. Now, here, an egalitarian reading is going to emphasize the fact that God, that Adam is entirely passive in this act of God. That in the same way that Adam, or the man, the Adam, was actively created by God, the woman is also actively created by God from an entirely passive man. She does not owe her creation to him in any sense, because it is something that God did. In addition, many egalitarian interpreters argue that rib, and it really is a really unfortunate translation of this word. What it really means is side. And I'll just give you an example of a reading of this. Matthew Henry was a late 17th century, early 18th century Presbyterian minister and scholar. And he wrote a very famous, gigantic set of commentaries on every single verse of the Bible, an exegetical look at every verse of the Bible. And on this passage, he says this: the man was made of a rib out of the side of Adam, not made out of his head to rule over him, nor out of his feet to be trampled upon by him, but out of his side to be equal with him, under his arm to be protected, and near his heart to be beloved. That's a very different understanding of the significance of the woman coming from the side than just this sort of throwaway rib, right? It's that was purposeful that she came from the side. Okay. In addition, For an egalitarian scholar, it's also actually important for many of them that the woman was made out of the same thing that the original Adam was made out of. She wasn't made out of something else, so that they are dissimilar from each other. They are created from the same stuff. And in that sense, makes them very interconnected in an important way. Okay. So then when the man wakes up and he sees this woman that has been created, and I've seen no hierarchy so far if I'm an egalitarian interpreter, right? He sees her, and this recognition that they are the same comes out of him, right? And from an egalitarian perspective, this is a recognition of sameness, of equality, right? So this is at last bone of my bones, right? We're the same. Flesh of my flesh, we're the same. And our interrelatedness, he makes a play on words. She's Isha because she came out of Ish. We are the same, right? Okay. Up to this point, from an egalitarian perspective, there has been no hierarchy in the text. Does everyone understand that? Okay. This is where hierarchy appears. As punishment, from an egalitarian perspective, rather than this sort of equal, mutual relationship between men and women that was God's original intention in the good creation, now the woman will be placed in a position subordinate to God. And this subordination will take some very unfortunate and violent and difficult turns throughout history. But it is a result not of the good creation, but rather it is a result of her choice. And then the man himself is also. Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Have you heard of this argument is that there was some difficulty in interpreting shall and will, and that this is not necessarily a command of God?
Of course, yes.
That man will rule over women?
Right. So rather than it being a prescriptive,
right,
so something that is going to be forever and for all time, uh-huh, it is instead descriptive, right? Uh-huh. It's just a description of this particular, yes, of course, that is a very prevalent argument from an egalitarian perspective. There are so many different interpretations that would fall under the umbrella of egalitarian, and I can't do them all. Uh-huh. So I'm just running through with this one, but you're absolutely right. That would also be an argument of, is this prescriptive or is this descriptive? As a command. Mm-hmm. Now, continuing in the punishment of the man, in the ancient world, it was very common for the exercise of naming something or naming someone to be an exercise of authority. So from an egalitarian perspective, it makes perfect sense that at this point, the man names the woman. Because now he is in a position to do it. Now he is in a position of authority to name her as Eve. So in his first act of authority over her, he gives her a name. Okay, so let's just clarify these two different positions on Genesis. From a complementarian perspective, when you read through the text, the hierarchy comes from the moment of creation itself. Right? Hierarchy, or the position of the man in authority over the woman, was something that was a part of God's plan, right? And was a part of what God called good. And therefore, later on, when the woman is punished by telling her that the man will rule over her, this isn't saying that there wasn't hierarchy or authority before. Instead, this is pointing out that a perversion of God's good hierarchy and authority design has happened. And that perversion is that now, with sin, men will treat women in a way that God never intended. That ruling over them will take the form of oppression and violence at times. Not because that is something that God intended men to do to women, but is a part of their punishment. From an egalitarian perspective, the hierarchy never existed until punishment took place. So in the act of creation, in the act in 27, when she was created, she was created not to be his assistant, but rather she was created to be his partner, right? Helper is an equal position rather than a subordinate position. She was created in order to have dominion with him. There was no distinction in chapter 1 from an egalitarian position. There was no distinction between what the woman was allowed to do versus what the man was allowed to do. And this then, this idea of God, that men and women should be in a mutual relationship with each other, in a mutual partnership, was then perverted with the fall. And her punishment was that she would be ruled over. Now what I want to point out in particular is the different way that these two readings are integrating or relating to each other's chapters 1 and chapters 2. So from a complementarian perspective, chapter 1 is being read through the lens of chapter 2. And from an egalitarian perspective, chapter 2 is being read through the lens of chapter 1. Let me explain what I mean. So from a complementarian perspective, they're privileging the creation of the man first, the woman taking out of him, the woman as subordinate helper of the man. And then when they look at chapter 1, they don't see anything there to dispute that. Right? They don't see anything there to say, oh, well, that's not the case. It's pretty, you know, I can see how those two things work together. But an egalitarian is going to look at chapter 1 and say, men and women are both in the image of God. They were both given the same instructions to rule together, and there's no distinction. And therefore, I'm going to read chapter 2 in light of that. So since in chapter 2, then, since they're both in the image of God, the fact that the man was created first does not make him more important. The fact that he was created first does not give him more of a role than her, right? Because they're reading chapter 2 through chapter 1. Does that make sense? I just want us to sit for a second on how fascinating that is and how much that can add to a discussion between people who have a different perspective once you can unpack that and see that which reading are you privileging? How are we doing this? How are we reading? That's a very different question. How are you reading? How are you getting to what you believe versus just saying this is what the text says? It's a much more constructive place from which to talk. Okay. Here. We out of time? Okay. All right. So, tomorrow, what we're going to do... Let's back up here. So, tomorrow what we're going to do is we're going to move into the New Testament. And we're going to talk... We talked about this original creation. And we're going to talk about Paul's apocalyptic context and how that informs his discussion of new creation and baptism. And then how one's reading of the original creation interacts with one's reading about the new creation in Paul. And then we're going to talk about the commonalities and disagreements between these two different readings and try to see where they might have common ground, where they might need to talk. Now, if you can't come back, you might have realized that list is really going to do this. So if we were just staying with Genesis 1 to 3, I might come out, right, and say, all right, I want to come together. I've determined where you're standing, and you've determined where I'm standing, and we see that you're reading chapter 1 through the lens of chapter 2, and you're reading chapter 2 through the lens of chapter 1, and you're seeing Azar this way, I'm seeing Azar this way, right? Now we can, all right, these are our points of commonality, right? We're both looking at the text, looking to see sort of normative, what are the relationships God wants between men and women? There's some major common beliefs between these two positions. And then we have disagreements. So let's figure out how can we sit down and talk about the relationship with Genesis 1 and 2, right? Let's talk about that. Let's have a discussion. that's a part of my root, but it's going to lead me back here, right? Because now I have to come together on Genesis 1 and 2. And I have to determine, again, how we're standing on these, where the other person is standing, what's the relationship between the 1 and 2, chapters 1 and 2 issue. The point being that this dialogue is continuous. It's continuous and it's hard. It's continuous and it's hard. But if we make space for each other and we recognize that it doesn't matter how unified things look on top, when those fractures are underneath because we're not talking to each other, then our community is already broken, whether it looks that way or not. The community is broken. The spirit is inhibited. We've got to find a way to deal with this. So I hope you'll come back tomorrow, and we'll do part two. Thank you for coming.